Hey, podcast fans. Thanks for joining me on The Wine Road. I have two intros on this week's recording. First, I apologize for the delay. I was hoping to get this out last week, but that nasty Kincaid fire erupted north of my Santa Rosa, California home, and that altered my ability to work efficiently. It's under control now, and we're fine. And I would be remiss not to offer a huge thank you to the 5,000 firefighters and other first responders who helped save three major communities north of us. You have our enduring respect and appreciation. Also, I wanted to give a special shout-out to the many folks I met who devour podcasts as much as I do wine and coffee. I mentioned on my Facebook page earlier this year that I took a position as a wine educator at Spring Mountain Vineyard in St. Helena, Napa Valley. It's iconic. It was one of the wines chosen for the Paris Tasting of 1976, also called the Judgment of Paris. Their Chardonnay came in fourth place in the white wine category as one of three American wines in the top five. Chateau Montelena was first, Chalon Vineyard was third. I just work there a couple of days a week and love it. I find the guests so interesting and am fascinated by the coincidences, the overlap of interests, and the familiar stories that people share from across the country, even internationally. One common interest is podcast listening. So that's provided me the chance to mention this podcast, and I've been thrilled to pick up new followers while sharing the incredible wine from Spring Mountain. 2 weekends ago, I discovered two groups I was hosting, one from Wichita and the other from the Milwaukee area, had a common connection with my first guest in today's podcast, Angela from The Winery, A Tribute to Grace. It's another reminder that most of us share interests and goals wherever we live on this big blue marble we call home. Let's not forget that, and keep devouring podcasts. Maybe that will bring the world closer together. And that leads nicely into today's topic, Wine and Spirit Magazine's Top 100 event, held recently in San Francisco.
And that's been our goal all the time, to give you a real sense of place, a distinctiveness to our wines. And I think that's why Wine and Spirits has given us those accolades, because it is a distinctive wine.
16 years ago, decided to do an internship in South Africa, fell in love with the country and the wines and the people, and stayed and started a winery, and then another one.
Last year, we tasted 15,000 wines.
Right.
This year, we tasted 11,500 wines. So we cut back dramatically, but the wines we were tasting were better quality and more characterful.
He's Joshua Green, the senior editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. The Top 100 event features the best wineries in the world according to the talented tasters at Wine and Spirits magazine. It's one glorious evening of wine and food tasting that also benefits San Francisco Baykeeper, a nonprofit environmental organization that works to protect and preserve the San Francisco Bay. A few weeks ago, as I was reading Wine and Spirit magazine's 13th annual buying guide, which features the top 100 wineries, the first one listed in the U.S. section was interesting to me. The name of the brand is actually a statement, the one I mentioned earlier, A Tribute to Grace. Winemaker Angela Osborne is a fairly young New Zealand woman, a Kiwi, who now lives north of Santa Barbara in Los Alamos near the Santa Ynez Valley AVA, American Viticultural Area. And it was how she became a winemaker that I found so surprising.
So I often ask people, what was your epiphany wine that made you become a wine enthusiast? And for you, not only was there a wine, but it actually inspired you to change your career path. And that's remarkable.
It was a remarkable moment. The wine was Unti Vineyard 1999. It was in 2002 when I was doing a harvest in Sonoma, and I was working for a Kiwi winemaker called Nick Goldschmidt. And I'd never done a harvest in my life, and I just finished film school, and they somehow the gods aligned, and we decided that I should do a 3-month stint in California, which was weird because I was planning on making documentaries.
I say we, yeah. I mean my mother and I, because I'm looking at her across the table.
Oh, is she your partner in what was going to be the documentary career?
Kind of. I spent a long 5 years studying and finally graduating from film school. And then I had this very sort of about turn and thought maybe I'll just go to California for 3 months before I come back and be a documentary filmmaker. And I'm an only child, so we were very close.
Oh.
And I remember her driving me to the airport and saying, I feel like you'll be gone for a long time. And I said, no, don't be silly. I'm only going for 3 months. And I was 24 at the time, and I'm still here. Wow. 17 years later.
But as you mentioned, she's here tonight too, so at least she gets to enjoy your celebrity.
Oh, it's not a celebrity, but it's certainly an honor. And she comes and helps us for harvest every year with her husband, my stepdad. We have three young children, and harvest is a crazy time of year, so yeah, she comes and helps us with the family and the harvest.
You know, on a side note, my epiphany wine was an old vine Grenache from Barossa Valley in Australia, and I was thinking, you know, you were so close to Australia, but you never had a Grenache before you came here, huh?
Well, it's a good question. I worked in a wine shop all the way through film school, and I had lots of GSMs, and in those days, the G was very faint, and the style was very big, and I never knew the grace of Grenache until that Unti moment, and it was a single varietal, and it was all the things that I loved, and I also didn't know could exist in one grape. And I decided not only did I want to make wine, but I wanted to make that grape. But what was that epiphany old vine Barossa Grenache for you?
It was a Betts and Scholl.
Ah.
Just a couple of guys that got together, and they just did like 1 or 2 years. Yeah. So it was one of those that you just fell in love with, and then it was gone.
You know? Yeah, I had that once. It's a beautiful wine.
So how soon after you had that Grenache at Unti, did you say in your mind, this is what I'm going to do?
That second.
That second?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even finish the glass, huh?
No, it wasn't a very big glass.
Well, it was a taste, right?
It was a taste, yeah.
That's remarkable. Now, what about coming up with the name, which is more of a statement, a tribute to grace? How soon did that come along?
So that first wine was in 2002, and after Bet Harvest, I worked in a wine shop in San Diego for a while, and then I moved to the UK, and I lived in London for 3 years selling wine. I had this strange notion that if I wanted to make wine, I had to know how to sell it, which it turned out that was a good thing to think at the time. So I worked as a wine rep, and I saw the movie Sideways in 2006. And I'd been to the Santa Rita Hills and that whole region, the San Ynez Valley, once during that first stint in the States. And I was living in this dodgy part of London, the only part that I could afford where I could have a garden. And I walked on a winter's night up to the movie theater past like graffitied, corrugated iron, pull down covers in front of all the stores. And sat down and watched that movie and thought, I think it's time to move back to California. So I moved back about 2 months later with £300 in my pocket. And I had Thanksgiving about 2 weeks after I got here, and I was walking on the beach, and I was thinking of my Nana Grace and how she would love this American tradition because she was from New Zealand. And then I just felt compelled to write Grace in the sand with my foot, and I stood back and I saw the word Grace written with the big toe of my right foot, and thought, that's my label. I'm going to call it a tribute to Grace, and that will be the label, Grace written in sand.
Yeah.
And then my oldest and dearest friend from New Zealand, I showed her my label concept, and she thought that was a really bad idea and everyone would think that the wine tasted like sand. So she took it away and designed the label and sent it back. And I was like, oh, that's much better. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, at least it's still kind of written in cursive, like I think you did in the sand, right?
That is called Jane Austen font, and it's the closest to my foot font that exists.
Okay.
Yeah.
We should also back up a little bit to when you tasted Grenache, the word grace came to you.
Yeah. I wasn't raised with really a set religion, spirituality certainly, but grace is a very amazing strength. It's a female strength, but it has a structure and a frame to it, and that was what I thought of when I tried that first Grenache.
I've described wines in the past as elegant, silky, and similar words, but I've never come up with grace or graceful, and I love that. That's a great description for some Grenaches and some Pinot Noirs, those kind of wines.
I agree. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
That's certainly a touching tribute to your, what'd you call her, your Nana?
Yeah, we say Nana in New Zealand. Nana Grace.
You've been sourcing from a number of regions, and you worked in a number of regions up here in Sonoma County and Napa Valley and Sierra Foothills. How did you end up settling in Los Alamos?
The main source of my project is a vineyard called the Santa Barbara Highlands, which is the first vineyard I sourced fruit from in 07, and it's high in the Sierra Madre Mountains, east of Santa Barbara, eastern point of the county. And when I was living in Northern California, it was a good 8-hour commute each way to check on the grapes, and in the middle of harvest, that's almost impossible. So I tried it for 3 years, and then I thought it would make more sense to move back to place that was closest to that site. And I also love the open skies of the Central Coast. Similar to that silly Sideways. It wasn't silly, but right. The Sideways movie that...
Yeah, real close to that yeah. region.
It's just open skies, open minds, really. People of our tribe, yeah, we love it.
I read just by coincidence, I came across that and saw that it's one of the coolest, if not the coolest, vineyard in the entire state. And then you also source from warmer regions. So you must have different variations on the Grenache that you're able to make.
Yeah, so we source from the Sierra foothills, and then we were sourcing from Sonoma and all the way down to eastern Los Angeles. So we cover, I think it's over 700 miles if we were to drive one to the other. It's over 1,000 kilometers, I know that.
So do you have a richer, warmer climate, Grenache, and also the cool climate version?
We have a richer, warmer climate, a very cool climate, which I was told if they could ripen Grenache there, we could ripen Grenache in New Zealand. That got my attention because as yet we haven't done that. New Zealand has one planting that I know of, and out of 10 vintages, they've produced one wine. So it's not potentially the grape of my homeland. And then everything in between.
Right, right. Well, congratulations. I mean, it must have been a shock when you heard from Wine and Spirits.
I actually thought it was a spam email. And then I thought maybe I should just check, and then I nearly fell off my chair. And I definitely screamed or sort of yelped or made some funny sound in my old house, and my baby wasn't sure what was going on. Yeah, it was a huge surprise.
And your husband, let's talk briefly about him. Is he involved at all?
Yeah, he's amazing.
So aside from watching the kids?
He's watching the kids while I'm up here and doing the work in the cellar and checking on the vines. But yeah, he's an integral part. He's not from wine. He is a biodynamic cranial sacral therapist, which is about the best thing a winemaker could have during harvest or a pregnant woman could have during that magical time of a woman's life. But his craft is a bit harder to practice in this country. So he is from England, but spent a long time in New Zealand, and that's where he trained in his modality. And here, that is his magic, but by day, he is our logistics man and our truck driving man and pieces everything together.
Well, that's him on your website. I think that's where I saw a photo of him. He fits very naturally in a vineyard.
Yeah, he does. He's from Cornwall. I don't think there's a single vineyard in Cornwall. If there is, it's not a very big one, but yeah. He's a man of nature, so he loves it.
Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with me a little bit. And again, congratulations on this amazing achievement.
Oh, thank you. I'm about to burst into tears, so thank you.
Angela Osborne of A Tribute to Grace. She changed her course, setting aside 5 years of study and a planned filmmaking career because she fell in love with Grenache. Wow, I love that story. She mentioned other bottlings. For the 2016 vintage, she crafted Grenache from 8 different vineyards. She told me now that she's had a third child, she's had to cut back on the amount of vineyards she sources from. She also makes rosé and just released a sparkling wine this year that has already sold out. Find out more at gracewinecompany.com. Now I'm going to step aside from the winemakers to talk with Wine and Spirit magazine senior editor Joshua Green. This will give you a chance to hear about the process they use in choosing the top 100. It's astonishing the amount of wine they taste throughout the year. As you'll hear, I got to be part of the tastings a couple of years ago. In those first round tastings, we'd go through like 40 in less than an hour. I was looking forward to talking with Joshua about something that caught my eye with this year's list of wineries. There were only about a third of the wineries who attended last year. That's an unusual change from the typical year-to-year list. Then I came across his editor's note on page 1 of the magazine that explained they did adjust the tastings policy to focus on carefully farmed, low-intervention wines that have become increasingly present in recent years.
We had been very open, allowing everyone to send us wine. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you can't count on people to behave themselves. So a lot of people were sending us a lot of wine that was the same wine in different packages with different labels from different countries. Not so much from the U.S., but from other places. And we were getting really inundated with a lot of unnecessary wine to taste. And so we really decided we didn't want to bar people from sending us wine, but we wanted to put the brakes on people sending us wine that we didn't need to taste.
Right.
And so we really focused on the regions we wanted to taste, and we are cycling through those regions every 2 years. And so we could go deeper into the regions we were interested in. We used to recommend 30% of the wines at most of what we tasted. This year we recommended 50% of the wines we tasted. We tasted fewer wines. Last year we tasted 15,000 wines.
Right.
This year we tasted 11,500 wines. So we cut back dramatically, but the wines we were tasting were better quality and more characterful. And so the outcome is that there are a lot of people who are regulars here that are wineries of the year, top 100 wineries almost every year.
Right.
But there are also a lot of new people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, being from the Sonoma Napa region, I've been talking quite a bit about sustainable farming practices, which has been a major push up there for the last recent years. And also the Italians slow wine movement has made a major impact. And it looks like you're focusing more on that kind of style.
Not by any sort of intention. Mm-hmm. We rate the wines we rate based on all we know when we taste the wine is its region, its variety or varietal blend, and its vintage. So we rate the wines and how they express themselves in the context of a blind tasting. I mean, that's not completely blind because we know those three factors, but the people reacting on the panel to the wine is how we assess it. And the wines that are low intervention, the wines that are grown with intention to bring out the character of the place. Mm-hmm. You know, I was looking at an interview I did maybe 10 years ago where I said that we really are looking for wines that express a sense of place. And somebody wrote into that particular blog post, "What is this bullshit sense of place?" And the writer defended me and he said, well, if anyone is in a place to articulate what sense of place is about, it's the people at Wine and Spirits because they taste that way. They taste for that character. And we are looking for, because we know the region that the wine is from and the vintage that it's from, we're assessing it based on how much it tastes like a wine from that region.
Right.
Rather than looking at the brand and thinking, oh yeah, this is a spectacularly rare wine and we know that it's a rare wine, so we should think about it as a special wine and it must get a high score. No, we'll often recommend a wine, and actually we often recommend many wines that are the less ambitious wines from a producer because they're not fussed over and they actually taste like where they're from, rather than having all this other stuff around them that gets in the way of where it's from.
I had the extreme pleasure of working with Luke for a couple of years off and on and doing some tastings down here in San Francisco with you all, and I learned so much from him watching what his palate was like. And
well, Luke is a brilliant taster. He's a really talented, he's a super smart guy, and he has a tasting intelligence he's a knockout taster.
Yeah. And it was good to see so many wineries I've covered in the past returning this year. Radio Coteau, Ridge, Cobb, Gary Farrell, Chorus, and the many newcomers who are treating their vineyards and wines with the utmost care that you're focusing on now.
It's always really great to see those people returning. You know, Eric Sussman at Radio Coteau, the folks at Ridge make amazing wines. They're people you can rely on. I mean, the whole idea of the top 100 is that we're trying to pull out the names of the people you can rely on as a wine buyer. If you go into a store, this is a name you can trust. Ridge is certainly a name. If I see a Ridge wine, I'm willing to buy it, just sort of sight unseen. If I see a Radio Coteau wine, I'm willing to buy it sight unseen. And many of the producers here, I feel that way about.
Before I let you go, is there a standout that you feel is worth highlighting nationally or internationally? And if so, who would that be?
Oh, there's so many people here that
I knew that'd be a tough question.
I mean, there are 100 people here who I would say are standouts. Honestly, it's just, they're some of my personal favorites that are rare to see. They're not necessarily rare wines, but they're rare to see. Like, you know, I think that a wine like Luis Ancho's wine, Luis Ancho Rodriguez Vazquez, he's got one of the most beautiful wines in Spain. And Suertes del Marqués, some of the most beautiful wines in Spain. You've got the Vizels here. You've got Delphine and David Lemaire and Delphine Vassell are pouring here. You've got the Molyneux from South Africa pouring their, I don't know if you've had their straw wine, but it's just gorgeous. And they traveled up here from South Africa. You've got Felton Road with Blair Walter, who traveled up here from New Zealand. It's, I don't know, they're people from around the world with incredible wines, and there are 100 of them. So it's impossible to say which is my favorite or which are the best.
That's what makes this such an engaging, palate-pleasing event, and I appreciate you welcoming me every year.
Well, Jeff, it's great to have you here.
There is some good detail there, which gives you an idea of why I respect the magazine so much. And, you know, I also appreciate the fewer pages of ads they have compared to other wine magazines. He's the senior editor of Wine and Spirits, Joshua Green. The current issue not only highlights the top 100, it's also their 13th annual buying guide. Aside from the top wines from regions across the globe, which shows their score and prices, they also have the top 100 best buys of 2019. It's an excellent resource to discover incredible wines at reasonable prices. It also includes the top bottles for $10 or less. Wine and Spirits magazine is available at Barnes & Noble, other magazine stands, and online at wineandspiritsmagazine.com. When I prepare for attending and possibly interviewing winemakers during the Top 100 event, I pick out a few ahead of time I'd like to record. Some work out, some don't. Some I don't plan on, but do end up interviewing. That was the case with Andrea Molyneux from South Africa. Interestingly, she grew up in the Bay Area. Now remember, Wine and Spirits judges wine and chooses the best blindly. They don't know the people behind the wines, so it's an interesting coincidence. Her brand is simply called Molyneux, spelled M-U-L-L-I-N-E-U-X. I started by thanking Andrea for taking the time to step away from her table to go outdoors to talk with me.
Yeah, thanks. It's amazing to be here.
You know, I usually spend a lot of time doing research on my interviewees, so I know what's going on with them, and I just met you tonight, so I know nothing about your history, other than you are from the Bay Area, but yet you're making wines in South Africa.
Yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area and worked in the Napa Valley for a few years at a few wineries there, and 16 years ago decided to do an internship in South Africa, fell in love with the country and the wines and the people, and stayed and started a winery, and then another one.
And what an interesting project you're working on, because you're focusing on the different soils and different regions, but how they differ from one another, yet even though the winemaking practices are similar.
Yeah, so it's interesting. In South Africa, we have some of the oldest viticultural soils in the world, so it allows to really focus on single soil types. When you have really old decomposed soils, you have very large areas of single soil types, and so we're able to make wines identically to each other with only the soils differentiating between them.
It spotlights the emphasis on terroir, how a particular site has its own characteristics and how it differs from block to block or acre to acre.
Absolutely. So, you know, the idea is that the vineyards are the same age, the clones are the same, the rainfall is the same. And so we do feel that the biggest fingerprint on the terroir is the soil in which they're grown. So tonight I'm sharing my schist wines, which have more structure and more sort of a broodiness to them. I also make wines on granite soils, which are more perfumed and linear, and iron soils, which are very perfumed but more broad and open up front.
My listeners may be familiar with my interview with Clay Moritzen, who was doing a similar project with three different vineyards, very close to one another, but yet their Cabernet was so different when you taste each one, even though they were processed and farmed similarly. You're working with Syrah.
Yeah, so primarily with Syrah, but then I also do the same concept with Chenin. So I do Chenin on quartz soils, which I always say bring a spark of sunshine, and then granite, which is that same perfume and linearity, and schist soils for structure.
Ah, great. Is this the first time here?
It's my first time at the Wine and Spirits Top 100, yeah.
Well, yeah, I know you've been in the Bay Area before.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations for being accepted this year.
No, thank you. It's so exciting to be here. And, we're the only South African winery here today, so we're representing South Africa as well.
That's spectacular, isn't it? What a great opportunity you've had. And you're so young, so tell me how you got started in this business.
So I always tell people, until I was 17, I wanted to be an astronaut. I was a huge science nerd and decided, having grown up in an Italian-American family where science and art and culture and food and wine was always, you know, part of the conversation around the dinner table, when it came time to studying at university, wine was like the natural direction to go into.
A lofty goal, but you came down to the Terra and you're here on Earth now making wine. So, but what a great place to be.
Absolutely. I mean, wine's the perfect combination of science and art, and I really am in my element here.
Definitely. And your husband, what is his contribution?
So I'm in charge of the wines, and my husband's in charge of the viticulture and everything else. So he is from South Africa, and he was a qualified accountant before he had his 20-something-year-old midlife crisis and decided to go back and study viticulture in university.
Well, I'll tell you, as you probably know, working in a winery and owning one, an accountant is very important.
It's the most important part of the job.
Right, yeah. Right. As they say, it's easy to make wine, it's harder to sell it.
Yeah. No, I mean, to be able to do an actual proper business projection is very important when you have someone that just wants to be artistic in the winery.
Are you having fun tonight?
It's a great night, beautiful night. San Francisco is just phenomenal. I love coming back here.
Yeah, I bet. And how fun to walk around and taste wines from all over the world.
The options here tonight are incredible. It's impossible to have to pour out or spit wine in front of someone because everything is just perfect that you're tasting.
We were just talking about that. We should be spitting because you're drinking and tasting so much, but it's hard to do that.
Yeah, but we're all professionals here.
That's right. That's right. Stand back. I'm a professional. It's okay. Well, nice talking with you and nice meeting you tonight. What a wonderful surprise.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to meet you.
Andrea of Melanieu Wines. I tried her 2016 Swartland Schist Syrah, which was foot-stomped and fermented in open-top barrels. It featured a Syrah flavor we've become accustomed to with blackberries, black pepper, and herbs. That entry and their 2017 Swartland Straw Wine received some of the highest points in the top 100, 96 and 97, respectively. You can find more details about them at mlfwines.com. Prior to the event, I recorded this next interview to get a jump on at least one of them. It's in the NorCal neighborhood, Storybook Mountain Vineyards, north of Calistoga in Napa Valley. I sat with owner Dr. Jerry Sepps in his office, and what a long history he has on this historic property. It was in 1976 that Jerry and his wife Sigrid found the piece of land and immediately fell in love with it.
Well, that was literally it. We came here one late afternoon. The realtor said she'd meet us at the gate. It was an old abandoned property at that time. There's nothing here. Just a chain across the road, and we came in, and where there's now a pond, there used to be a meadow, and there were deer playing in the meadow. And that's when I still love deer, other than on my plate. But then we came around that corner right there, and there are these redwood trees, and there are three shadowy entrances to enter the mountain. Turned out to be the caves that we just visited. And you're right, we did fall in love with it. And it's kind of love at first sight, and it's been the same now for over 40 years. Still get the same impression when we come in that front gate.
Oh, that's great. And since you released your first vintage, you've been winning all kinds of accolades over the decades. And Wine and Spirits magazine has certainly been a fan of your winemaking style. And this year it'll be your 15th appearance at the top 100.
Yes, we're quite proud of that. And it's nice to have that kind of recognition. And we're one of the few in the Valley. I think there are only three of us that have 15 awards that way.
And you were named Artisan Winery of the Year in 2003. And in 2005, wine critic Robert Parker referred to Storybrooke as crafting one of the six best Zinfandels in the world.
Well, I'm sorry, I just said one of the six anyway.
Yeah, and I'm sure Ridge is one of them.
Yeah, Ridge I'm sure is too. Yeah.
Out of the whole world, that's pretty good.
Can't complain about that.
And you were a professor at the time. Where were you teaching and what were you teaching in?
I was teaching down in Southern California at one of the state universities. I was teaching European history. But I'd been educated up here in Northern California and kind of really liked Northern California. So I was happy to come back.
What brought you up here that particular weekend when you found this property?
Well, we actually were looking for a place to buy up here, either in Napa or in Sonoma. And we looked for nearly 2 years before we found this property. It was kind of a change of lifestyle in part. We had four kids to raise and decided that academic life wasn't everything. So. Yeah.
But you kept teaching for a couple more years.
I did indeed. You had to have that income coming in.
Right. That was quite a commute.
It was. We used to come up here when we started this place. As I said, it was abandoned, so we had a lot of work to do. We used to come up here and work 3 days, sleep in the back of the pickup truck that we had, and then drive down to Southern California. I had enough seniority where I could get my classes concentrated and teach for 3 days and then come on and back.
Oh, great.
That's a cycle you don't want to repeat too much.
Right. And I just saw your daughter out there. You pointed her out, and there she was in mudder boots and with a hose. And so the life continues for her.
That's right, you know. And I think one of the reasons we win those accolades is the fact that we have good people working for us. Not least my daughter, of course, but we have the same Mexican family from Michoacan, worked for us for over 40 years now.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
And they're really crucial for us doing well. And our cellar masters worked for us for a couple of decades. It just, those things are important. They kind of want this place to succeed on their own, and that's a great help.
Are you the primary winemaker?
I am the primary winemaker.
That's great.
Yeah.
You make Cabernet, Viognier, and the Rosé, as you mentioned, but what do you think is so appealing about your Zinfandel?
I think it's appealing because it really shows a sense of place. We are in a very unusual place in the Napa Valley. This is the coolest vineyard in the north part of the Napa Valley. Our heat summation is the same as Canaris. Actually, we're a couple degrees cooler on occasion.
Oh, wow.
We face east. There's a big gap in the hills, a chalk hill gap. So we get the breezes off the ocean quite often. And we have nearly as much fog as Canaris. So it's a really cool site. So the combination of a cool site, particular soil, we have volcanic soils. It tends to bring out certain aspects of the wine, kind of a black cherry aspect, perhaps more than other soils would. That coolness makes for a more delicate wine. It kind of gives you a better acid pH balance in the wine. So what we're trying to do is produce from the site that which it will yield best. And that's been our goal all the time, sure, to give you a real sense of place, a distinctiveness to our wines. And I think that's why Wine and Spirits has given us those accolades, mm-hmm, because it is a distinctive wine.
Storybook Mountain Winery's label is distinctive, too. It's a throwback to an earlier era, not just the 1970s, but also a time that's fitting for the history of the winery.
That label is something that was designed for us then, and we've stuck with it all the time. It's really identifiable. It's got the Fox and the Grapes logo on it, and so we've kept with that label.
Why don't you explain to the listeners how you came up with the name for the winery and its history before you came here?
Okay. Well, this winery was actually founded by two brothers named Grimm, Jacob and Adam Grimm. And they came up here in 1883 and decided that Zinfandel would go well here. It was among the five varieties they planted. Cabernet was one of the others. And we decided maybe not to call it the Grimm Winery, which was its old name. So we thought we'd honor them by calling it Storybook, partially because of the beauty of the location as well as the brothers Grimm. And I think wine should be like a story. It should somehow enhance your life. And so for all three reasons, we've named it Storybook Mountain.
And not only enhance your life, but each bottle of wine really has its own life and story to tell.
It really does. And our wines have amazing longevity, so that story tends to go on and on.
Oh, great, yeah. How long can you lay yours down, do you think?
Well, the wine that we had for last Christmas was our 1980, and it was doing very well. And one of the things that is often cited in Wine and Spirits, now that you mention it, is the ageability of our wines, particularly our reserves. And 30 years is not unusual, and 40 is quite possible.
Awesome. And how stunning those caves are that you mentioned briefly earlier. You have, like you said, three
corridors or so, and got that nice, rich, thick black mold on the walls that just gives it that historic elegance in a sense.
That patina of age, yes, right. Yeah, well, you know, as I mentioned, French think that adds to the character of the wine. Who knows? Maybe that's part of the character of Storybook Mountain. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's certainly part of the story anyway.
That is indeed, yeah.
Boy, those Chinese immigrants that built that cave and a number of others around here in this area, what an effort.
It is, and those are the people that aren't often recognized, and I'm glad you mentioned that. It's just like the Mexican family that works for us. Without those people doing that kind of hard labor, we would not be the valley. We would not have the fame that we have now.
And you are so fortunate to have a family that has that knows this property so well for 40 years. When I hear winemakers and vintners talk about that, 25, 30, 40 years, that is such a major leg up on what you're doing.
I think it is because for a couple of reasons. One, the family regards it as almost their property. If people come up from Michoacan to visit, they show them their caves and their vineyards, etc. But also it gives us a flexibility, an ability to work with the grapes a little closer. For instance, on a Sunday, if I want to pick 6 rows and 2 tons, they'll come and pick. I don't have to contract for a crew. We can pick over a 6-week period because we pick when every row is ripe. So it's an amazing asset to have, and I'm really thankful for it.
Does it help to offer a couple of cases of cervezas to get them over here on a Sunday?
I could, I have, but I think they just, it's pride of working here,
sure.
And they take pride in our success, and that's a great thing.
You know, another person that has touched many people around Northern California wine industry is Andre Chelischev. I mean, his name has been mentioned on my show so many times in the last 6 years, and he helped you as well.
He did. When we bought the property, as I said, it was abandoned. We did all the research on the soil and the climate and the exposure and the topography. And there were a number of varieties that would work here, and primarily red because of our volcanic soil. But it was the words of Chelischev that made the final decision. He just said there's no finer place than the red clay soils above Calistoga, the volcanic soils, to have Zinfandel. So we said, well, we'll do that.
Gosh.
Yeah. So it was a good decision, it turns out.
It's amazing what that guy had in his mind, you know. And it could be Zinfandel here. It could be Cabernet over there.
That's right. Malbec somewhere else, or it could be Merlot. And, you know, he just had a feeling for the land, having been here, having been raised in Russia from his parents having grapes. I can't say it was in the blood necessarily, but it was certainly very close to that.
Right. Did Sigrid have the same emotion and desire to move here that you did when you saw this property? Was she right there along with you?
I think she was. She's the one that kind of coined that phrase, it's love at first sight. And she was out there doing work with me. She helped me dig ditches for the irrigation system. She helped me put up the fences and the barbed wire around the property. She worked right alongside me for those first decades. And without her help, we would not be up here and we would not be a success.
Well, it's awesome to have a partner like that and then to have your children come along too. It's like the old ranch days where your children were part of the workforce and they're right there and then you're looking forward to them to carrying on the tradition.
I really am. Of course, their view of it was that we used them as slave labor when they were kids, you know, get out there and hold the vineyard and make sure the water lines are placed properly and all that kind of thing. But my daughter decided after she had graduated from college, she was going on to law school, and it turned out my secretary had quit in May, and she said, oh, Dad, I'll come to work for you this summer, earn some money, and then go on to law school. And it's my good fortune that she never left.
Wow. How many summers ago was that?
Oh, my gosh, it's about 30 years ago.
Well, congratulations again, and this is going to air after the Top 100, but I'll look forward to seeing you again on Thursday.
Great. Come and taste our wine.
And I most certainly did. I enjoyed all 3 of the expressions of Zinfandel that he had on hand. And he scored a 96 with his 2015 Napa Valley Estate Reserve Zinfandel. I called over to the winery today because I was very concerned for them. The Kincaid Fire ended up being frighteningly close, but didn't quite drift that far southeast, thankfully. He's Dr. Jerry Sepps, who, with his family, has been crafting world-class wine in the hills above Napa Valley for over 40 years, and they've been deemed a Wine and Spirits Magazine Top 100 Winery of the World. Don't miss out. Pay them a visit sometime soon and sample the wine. They're online at storybookwines.com. I didn't have time this year to interview other top 100 winemakers from outside the U.S., other than Andrea Milano, but in recent years I have. Since I have a little more time on this podcast, I thought I'd include them as well. One of the sharpest international winery attendees I met was João Ribeiro of Quinta do Valado from the Douro region in Portugal. He's a member of a family, as you'll hear, who has owned vineyards for a very long time.
Valado was one of the properties owned by the Ferreira family, actually owned by Don Antonio Ferreira, quite a famous figure in the Douro, and she was my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, so five times up.
Wow, that goes back like almost three centuries.
Almost 299 years, to be precise. And our history at Valado is divided into two parts. Valado was one of the main estates used to make port wines for the Ferreira brands. This happened until about 30 years ago, when my family sold the Ferreira port house, but the estate remained in our family, and we started our own brand, or our single estate project of making Quinta do Valado wines. Also at the time, we decided to stop producing exclusively port wines and start using the local terroir, the local varieties, and a lot of the local know-how, like foot treading of the grapes, to make different styles of wines for us, which meant dry wines or table wines.
And you were saying that it's a field blend, but you have them separated originally, and then you blend them later.
Exactly. So when we started our own project, our own brand project, we have 70 hectares of vineyards, all of which were a field blend, so mixed planted local varieties, whites and reds. We maintained roughly a third, so about 26 or 27 hectares of the oldest parcel of vineyards in a field blend with these over 40 varieties. And we identified the most important varieties we thought were good for dry wines, and we planted them separately. So now we have about two-thirds of vineyards with separate single varieties that we vinify separately and blend to make our entry-level and our biggest volume wines. But we still have the traditional old vineyards for port wines, which we still make, obviously. And we also make a dry red from those old vineyards.
And how many different varieties in the two-thirds?
In the two-thirds that we've replanted, we have seven red varieties and five white varieties that we've identified. And in the one-third of the oldest vineyards, because old vineyards, these are in the Douro, old vineyards are considered after 80 years of age. So in our case, they're between 80 and 110 or 115 years of age. As they get older, they will produce less and less and less. They get to a point where it's not viable anymore. So we actually have to do a genetic study every couple of years to identify what we have in the blend. So as they start dying off, we can replant them, or we can replace them with a similar variety or similar blend. So we have identified so far 11 white varieties and 33 red varieties in this blend.
But you're keeping it going, though.
The goal is, well, my family has made a few things in a certain way for the last 300 years, so...
You don't want to be the one to mess that up.
I'm definitely not going to be the one that's going to mess that up. Maybe in 300 years' time, my great-great-great-great-grandkids will change a thing or two, but our goal is to try and keep on...
I think you ought to leave a note that they find in a few hundred years. Don't mess with the varieties.
Dig it somewhere in. Well, my great-great-great-grandmothers, they left us this nice note in form of very old port wines. So even last year, we bottled a single harvest Colheita port from 1866. So I think that's enough notice from the previous generations of this is how we did it then. Try it 150 years later. If you like it, don't change it.
Wow,
that's
quite a story.
Thank you.
João Ribeiro of Quinta do Valado. I must say that's the first time I've interviewed anyone from a vineyard and winery founded in 1718. My wife and I are planning a trip to Portugal next spring, and I'm so looking forward to it. I love port and a number of the Portuguese varieties. One of the most interesting wines I tasted during the Top 100 was back in 2016. It was a sparkling rosé crafted by Aleš Kristancic of Slovenia. As you'll hear, his winemaking philosophy is unconventional, and he shares some interesting opinions on winemaking. He's one of those people that gets more passionate as he talks with you. He was putting his hand on my shoulder and standing about 10 inches from me while I was recording him. What a character, as you'll hear. Listen to how he crafts his all-natural Puro Rosé.
It's produced with 100% just grape juice. It means for second fermentation, normally you use sugar, right. But I invented the method where I add must, which is just...
From the grapes?
Yes, from the grapes.
Let me interject here. Must is part of the leftover grape skins, seeds, and stems following fermentation. The solid portion is referred to as pumice. Must can be used as a sweetener because it contains about 1 to 15% high glucose content.
In that way, you don't increase the alcohol, and also you can make the wine with natural yeast, not with added yeast, you know?
That's clever, because, yeah, like you said, it doesn't raise the alcohol.
Doesn't raise the alcohol, because from the beginning, first you dilute. No, if you add sugar, sugar is without water, and it's not coming from normally from the vine, no? Mm-hmm. Adding most is, you know, is totally another...
Well, you might as well use it. It's laying around, right?
It's, I believe in that, you know, wine is something so special, and we have to take care that we don't lose the position of wine.
Yeah.
You know, wine is something really high, no?
Now, I understand in your sparkling, the yeast sediment that usually is disgorged, as they call it, is knocked out. Yeah. You leave it in your bottle when you sell it.
Yes, we disgorge at the moment when you open a bottle, no?
To enjoy it.
Yes.
To drink it.
Yes, and you know why? Because... In that way, I can really give to you pure wine, even without any sulfite added. You know what means that? That today you can drink, and tomorrow morning you can also drink again. It's not punishment after. I think that it's coming time when we will need to come back a little bit. Maybe we don't
step back
need,
in tradition.
Yeah, maybe we don't need to know so many things about wine or to know how to describe the taste. This is not so important because on the end the taste is yours and only what you feel, only that is important.
Yeah.
It's very stupid to be taught what you can find in some wine. This is, I think, not productive, no? But what is important is to know sometimes that... you know, I have to close the life in a bottle. And life is life. Life could be also a little bit tired. Life needs a cool place. Life needs special treatment. More people I find with knowledge, more I can be real. That's
you kind of let it live on its own, don't you?
Yes.
I imagine with the yeast still in the bottle... The flavors continually change.
Wine could be forever, you know. Like we, if you see our ID, we don't have any date of expirement. And if you see the label of wine, of any wine, it's without expirement date. What means that? Only if you are alive. Of course, we are not, after 20 years of life, we are not the same. We are different.
Right.
But we are not out of... the date of expirement.
Yeah, and, you know, we get better with age, don't we?
Yeah, we have to believe in that, yes.
So you're working with vineyards that are, you've been in your family since the early 1800s.
Huh? Yeah, I'm the eighth generation. We was the only winery which was always private, also in a difficult time of Yugoslavia when was not allowed to be private, but we had a special permission.
You have a lot more freedom now.
Of course, now it's now it's different. Now we can breathe much better.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you've been here before at the top 100 tasting?
Yeah. This is for me. I was 7 times selected. I'm very proud of that, special because you know, Wine and Spirits is becoming really a magazine which have trust because they are not using too many space for PR. They are not
advertisement,
and they are much more pure and clean with writing.
I agree.
And I appreciate a lot Josh Green with his really tremendous job to be so open, let's say, for you know, wine. Still today, everybody who is listening to our conversation has to understand that we can discover still today many things.
That's what's amazing about
it. Yes, and we can be like the hunter of
a few thousand years ago, which went in the forest and just discovered wine. For that, wine is so special. You know, we don't need to find out the new things to make shortcuts. This is unbelievable how today the world of business, winemaking, is going in the wrong direction.
It's going in the pursuit of the perfect wine, and we don't need to do that, do we?
No, wine. My father said, you know, that if you decide to do that job, you decide to have another different life. Farmer is somebody who have not just entrepreneur's risk, have also risk of nature. Without that risk, you are not producing food. You just can produce cars, but not wine. No, that's it.
If you didn't quite understand that last part, his father told him, as a farmer, you not only take the entrepreneur's risk, but the risk of nature as well. Without that risk, you're not producing food, so you just as easily could be making cars. So he has chosen to take the entrepreneurial risk and be creative. Aleš Kristancik. He's been a leader in the natural wine movement, and you can hear he's very passionate about it. His winery is Movia, M-O-V-I-A, in Goriška Brda, Slovenia. I hope you enjoyed today's interviews, recorded at the Metreon in San Francisco and at Storybook Mountain Winery. Find Wine & Spirit Magazine's 33rd Annual Buying Guide featuring the top 100 on newsstands now at Barnes & Noble and online at wineandspiritsmagazine.com. Click the Events tab, the top 100, and then Wineries. As usual, today's show was recorded, written, and produced by me. Music is from FirstCom. My website is onthewineroad.us. I'm on Facebook and YouTube as On The Wine Road, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at JDWineRoad. Next time, my guest will be the vineyard manager of Spring Mountain Vineyard during harvest. Catch you next time on The Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis.